You're someone who I found out a bit more about online as the blogging parson. Some of us might not know what a parson is, some might not even know what a blog is. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Okay, a blog is just a kind of it's a web log. It's like an internet diary sort of thing. A parson is a minister. I'm an Anglican minister, and there was a guy called Samuel Marsden back in the early days of New South Wales who was known as the flogging parson because he used to also operate as a magistrate during the week, and he was known for being particularly nasty. And people get whipped, you see. And then so this cheeky friend of mine said, "Why don't you call your blog the blogging?" Parsons. It's about that funny.
Is it because all the good names were taken? Or?
pretty much, yeah.
Well, it makes it easy to remember anyway.
Yeah.
On to tonight's topic, we have a video clip. Someone's going to do some magic somewhere here. And we're just going to watch a video clip from a BBC documentary. We're looking today at, it's an auspicious occasion at the moment because it's the 400th anniversary of the creation of the King James Bible. And we're just going to look at a clip from an independent BBC documentary about the Bible and an insight that the presenter had about that.
Conveying the mystery of the divine is the greatest of all challenges to language of any kind. The unfathomable nature of God and of the ultimate facts of existence are, by definition, unreachable. So when life deals its heaviest blows, where do you turn? Not long ago, I was talking to a fisherman whose son had died here off the coast of the Outer Hebrides. He was just 24. His father told me to read Psalm 77, saying in effect that I would find there everything he could ever think or feel about what had happened. Will the Lord cast off forever, and will he be favourable no more? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Thy way is in the sea, and thy path in the great waters, and thy footsteps are not known. These words aren't about consolation or the muffling of experience by religion. They're a statement to the cruelty of life and the unknowable purpose of God's universe. There is something miraculous about this, a poem written in the Near East in the Bronze Age, translated in England 400 years ago, still embodying some of the deepest and most powerful meanings that human beings can summon.
Okay, there's a few these and eyes there that might be alienating for the modern audience, but nonetheless, what do you take out of that video and what the presenter's saying there?
Well, I think exactly what he kind of came to that conclusion at the end, that this what's in this book is remarkably universal. So that, yes, it's foreign, it's distant from us in place by thousands and thousands of kilometres, and distance from us in time by so many, many years. And yet, some of the things that are talked about, the way the words of this this particular book, the Bible that we're talking about this evening, can touch us, can reach us even now in our experience. And as he said too, it's not with glib answers or kind of nice back rub, the kind of self-help message, but it kind of gives voice to our doubts even, our fears and our doubts in a way that is quite profound.
Cool. So sort of like a timeless message, I guess, in a way.
Timeless and timely, yeah. At the same time. Timeless kind of sounds like... you might take the wrong inference from the word timeless and think that it's kind of not relevant, but it's certainly timeless in that it's universal, it kind of carries across time, but timely in that these are the things, this kind of experience, this kind of feeling is something that we feel, that we sense even today as human beings, just as people did 3,000 years ago and so far away.
Sure. Yeah, and timely, I guess, for the gentleman who lost his son,
yes, yeah.
For instance. Michael, I'm going to hand over to you to tell us a bit more about yourself and about your understanding of this God book. So, you want to hold the mic?
I do. I'll just keep in the stand here.
So I'm going to say a few things about the impact and significance of the Bible and invite you really, what I want to do tonight is invite you to read it. It's as simple as that. The Bible is one of the most influential books that has ever been published. It's probably the most influential, and yet it's one of the books we kind of know by reputation and less by actually reading it. So tonight is an invitation to take up and read. It's just to read a book. Simply nothing much more complicated than that, in fact. And I want to start by introducing you to a man called William Tyndale. In 1536, it was October the 6th, in a little castle not far outside of Antwerp in modern-day Belgium, this man, William Tyndale, an English scholar, an Oxford academic, was burnt at the stake. He was burnt to death at the behest of King Henry VIII, he of the Six Wives, Tudors. You've seen that TV show. He wasn't on the TV show, but that's about him. King Henry VIII and his henchmen had this man, William Tyndale, the scholar, put to death. And as he died, it's reported he said these words. He said, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." William Tyndale, you see, had given his life to translating the Bible. He knew some eight languages, we understand, and he'd gone up to Oxford as a young man, a promising young man, with a career ahead of him. But he'd said there, he discovered in the Bible something so significant that he wanted others to share it. It had been illegal to translate the Bible into the English language since 1409, so for more than a century. And he knew this. He knew the cost and the risk of doing what he did. And yet he gave his career so that, as he said, the ploughboy would know more of the Bible in his own language than the local priest would. And so it turned out. He was so convinced that when people read the Bible, it had the power to transform them, the power to really reach into their lives and change it, that he gave his life to this project. But why was King Henry so threatened by this? Why was he so threatened and so alarmed that he would have Tyndale killed? Well, clearly this book has something about it that not only transforms people, but threatens those who are in charge, threatens those who have power. Now, Tyndale's work was the basis of the Bible we now know as the King James Version, published in 1611, 400 years old this year. And this book has become the single most influential book in the most widely spoken language in all of human history. It's not, I don't think that's far too much, just an exaggeration to say. Even our agnostic Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, recognises this, and she says, "What comes from the Bible has formed such an important part of our culture. It's impossible to understand Western literature without having that key of understanding the Bible stories and how Western literature builds on them and reflects them and deconstructs them and brings them back together." And of course, famously, recently, she challenged Tony Abbott to a Bible quiz. I'd really like to see that happen. You know, Tony Abbott, the mad monk, and Julia Gillard, the ex-Baptist, who would win? Could decide the government of the country on the basis of that, perhaps. Might do, you know, do better than having elections. We don't seem to be able to decide who's able to run us. But the arch-atheist, the kind of best-known atheist of our times, Richard Dawkins, has also said how significant the Bible is. And he said, the Bible contains phrases that make echoes in people's mind. They haunt our minds because we are a Christian culture. We come from a Christian culture. And not to know the King James Bible is to be, in some small way, barbarian. Barbarian. See, the Bible has left its indelible mark for the good. Even Gillard and Dawkins would recognise on Western culture, what we know as Western culture, everything we prize and value. For example, in the law, it has given us the notion of justice but with mercy. The fact that we administer mercy and try and rehabilitate criminals as well as to punish them. In our literature, in our great works of literature, from Shakespeare through to Melville, the author of Moby Dick, and to Hemingway in the 20th century, and to Australia's own Les Murray and Tim Winton, some of our favourite authors, the influence of the Bible is unmistakable on their work. In the area of psychology, we've learnt from the Bible the idea that we can look inside ourselves and give an account of a thing called a self that we might have. In the area of music, we can't imagine music without Bach on the one hand, and without the influence of gospel and soul, not unmistakably known as soul, on rock and roll and popular music in the late 20th and early 21st century. In the area of visual art and painting, we couldn't imagine Western art without the Christian, the biblical influence that's on that, right through again to the 20th and 21st century. In the area of commerce and economics, we think of the notion of the distribution of wealth and free market and the idea that you ought to work hard and dutifully and yet be a philanthropist. These come from the influence of the Bible on our economic system. In politics, we think of the values of equality and accountability and the style of democracy that we enjoy here. The Bible, it was people who were readers of the Bible who picked up the Bible who wanted to put an end to slavery, both in England and in America. We think of the idea of social welfare, the idea that we ought to look after those who are less well off, that we ought to protect the weak and the vulnerable. This is an idea brought to us through the influence of the Bible. In medicine and healthcare, the notion of the hospital, of caring for the sick, and also of nursing, again, comes from the influence of Scripture, of the Bible, in our culture. And even science, even in the area of science, the scientific method itself, which is so often thought to be opposed to the Bible, is unleashed by the worldview of the Bible, that thing we admire so much, our scientific know-how, our scientific skill. I just want to probe two examples here and show how the Bible has had this kind of mark, this stamp, this influence for the good on everything the things we hold dear in our culture, our society. First of all, I want to talk about equality, that notion that's so dear to the hearts of Australians. We think of course, the notion of egalitarianism and a fair go. It's one of our most beloved social values, you'd have to say, equality. The idea that we have an equal society. The principle that human beings everywhere and always share in the same equal dignity, which demands that we provide them with an equality of opportunity, an equal respect. That fair go, that's the way we speak of it, a fair go. And it comes from the biblical notion of the image of God. It's reflected in the US Declaration of Independence, penned by Thomas Jefferson, that great politician, who said, of course, you might remember the words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men," and apparently he meant all women as well, "are created equal." Now it's not really, the thing is, it's not really that self-evident. When we look around, when we examine the world, it's in fact apparent that people are not equal, that people do not have equal talents, people do not have equal situations, people are very different in these things. It's something that he got from his exposure to the worldview of the Bible. The British professor of economics at the London School of Economics, R.H. Tawney, he put it as nakedly as this. He says, "In order to believe in human equality, it is necessary to believe in God." And he meant the God of the Scriptures, the God of the Bible. Friedrich Nietzsche, on the other hand, the great atheistic German philosopher, knew that it was a Christian idea, this idea of equality, and he hated it. He thought it was a stupid, demeaning idea, and he criticised it with all the passion he could muster. From this notion of equality, this biblical notion of the image of God being shared amongst all human beings, is built the idea of human rights. And from this, the notion that we have the duty to ensure the equal treatment and opportunities for other human beings. Without the scriptural worldview, without the Bible's influence, would we have this value of equality? I don't think so. I also want to examine with another example of the Bible's positive influence on our Western culture would be in the area of science. And as I said before, it's a kind of surprising suggestion to many. And many people think that the scientific worldview, the advance of science, has been at the cost of Christianity. The Bible's worldview has retreated because of the advance of science. But the methodology that we now know as the scientific method emerges in the 17th century, and it's got many causes for its development, let's acknowledge that. But not least, of course, was the change of approach that was came about in that period to the Bible, that you could consult things for yourself, that it was something like what Tyndale imagined, everybody kind of consulting the facts in front of them for themselves. But it's the Bible's idea that the world is made by a rational and good God who orders things according to their kind, and yet that world is external to God, that world isn't God, that makes what we know as science possible, that makes the whole enterprise of science something that's possible to think of. The scientist has got the job, you see, of seeking natural causes in the external world. And so the scientists of the 17th century, people like Isaac Newton, who were strong believers, they didn't think that they were finding theological explanations for what they found. They were just trying to find how cause and effect worked in the world. They knew that science, as they practiced it, couldn't explain everything, but they believed that they'd been equipped by the divine creator with reason to explore the natural world as they found it. You see, the world was made good. And so you could go out into the world and examine it and find in it order. And you could find in it, you could expect to find order. Without this assumption, science cannot even begin. As Dr. Kirsten Burkett of London's Oak Hill College writes, she says, the very fabric of God's creation provides a rationale for the scientific enterprise. The world, as the Bible sees it, is comprehensible and predictable. It's a world which we might well be expected to study and investigate. The other thing the Bible says to us, which is crucial for the notion of science, is that human beings don't know everything, and that human beings make mistakes, and that human beings' knowledge needs to be checked and rechecked and rechecked. Without this, the scientific method doesn't advance by the process of check and balance and theory and test. It's the basis for that kind of worldview. Now, we might be surprised to think that there are other ways of seeing the world, but of course there are. Paganism, for example, which held that the world was just chaotic, it was just the result of gods fighting it out all the time, or pantheism, which holds that the world is God. Both these worldviews cause human beings to be rather afraid and reticent to examine the world in the way that we've found the scientific world method has enabled us to do. And it's conveyed to the Western culture a tremendous advantage, one that we've sometimes abused, we must acknowledge. An advantage, say, over China, which was very much more advanced in technology than the West was at a similar time, but did not have the same worldview. And so we have a tradition of believing scientists going from Isaac Newton through to a man like Michael Faraday, who experimented with electricity, and today to the man in charge of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, in America. Okay, so there's two ways in which the Bible has had a remarkable influence on our culture, on our way of thinking about the world. But is the Bible a reputable book? Because you could say, look, yeah, sure, it's had this influence. I mean, Dawkins clearly believes that that's the case. But it's not a reputable book, you might argue. It's still a bunch of fables manufactured by conspiracy and doctored by the church in order to kind of keep people in their place. Well, this really matters, of course, is a question when it comes to the Bible. Because the Bible is not a book like other religious texts. It's not merely a bunch of life wisdom. It's not merely a philosophy or a set of values or a moral code, as other religious books are. You see, the Bible is very different. It narrates a history. It tells a story, or purports to. It doesn't purport to be telling us just fables from which we might learn lessons, but it purports to be telling us things that actually did happen. And see, if that history turns out to be false or concocted or a hoax, then the credibility of Christianity crumbles immediately. The Quran, for example, has purportedly historical elements to it, but it doesn't depend on them. So if you show these things that didn't happen in history, it's less important for Islam that this history occurred, as I understand Islam. But for Christianity, if you show that the Bible's events are not events that actually occurred, it's not rooted in history, then in fact the Bible, Christianity indeed, crumbles. For example, if Jesus did not exist, or if the reports about him are discovered to be substantially untrue, then Christianity falls in a heap. Now, people have attacked the Bible in a number of ways in trying to kind of make this case that the Bible is not a historically reliable sort of book. Firstly, by arguing that Jesus never existed, or that we cannot ever know whether Jesus existed. This is actually a thing doing the rounds these days. They say, of course, that the only evidence we have from him is from Christian sources who are clearly biased, and biased sources clearly can't tell us anything true. And so that's the kind of conclusion drawn, that we can't actually know whether Jesus existed or not. So Christopher Hitchens, one of the other sort of most prominent atheists of our time, says that Jesus had a highly questionable existence in his view. And Dawkins says that there is a serious historical case that can be made that Jesus never lived at all. Those are his words. This is, however, simply and patently untrue. We have evidence about Jesus from a variety of sources. From Jewish sources and Roman sources and Greek sources. In fact, from sources that are highly critical about him, that knew what was claimed about him and disagreed with, hated what was said about him. In addition, how can anyone putting forward this case that Jesus never existed account for the existence of the church that came after him? Especially in the generation when Jesus' apostles were dying for what, if the theory is right, they knew was a fiction they concocted around the campfire late one night after a few too many Israel wines, or whatever it was they drank. Ancient historian Professor Graham Clark at the ANU in Canberra was happy to go on the record as saying this: "Frankly, I know of no ancient historian or biblical historian who would have a twinge of doubt about the existence of a Jesus Christ. The documentary evidence is simply overwhelming. No professional historian of whatever stripe doubts that Jesus existed." In fact, if you look more carefully at Richard Dawkins's text, he only quotes one scholar, Professor G.A. Wells. And if you look up Professor G.A. Wells, you find out that he's a professor and he does exist and he teaches in London, but he teaches German. What his expertise is to make pronouncements about history and Jesus' existence is, I'm not quite sure. Okay, so Jesus never existed? Well, that's not a reputable thing to say, according to professional historians of whatever stripe. But secondly, people will say that the texts of the Bible are full of errors, many, many errors, and the ancient manuscripts of the Bible, of which there are some 5,500 or so, disagree more than they agree. Indeed, one claim is made that there are some 400,000 errors in the manuscripts about the New Testament, and since there are only 150,000 words in the New Testament, that's a very significant number. Now, this is a highly misleading argument to say that we can't rely on those manuscripts because of these discrepancies and errors. Partly the number of differences in the manuscripts is because we have so many of them, because the documents of the New Testament are so well attested and so copied so often, we have so much evidence to deal with. If we only had one copy, we would not know that there were any mistakes. We wouldn't be able to check them at all. There are indeed differences between the manuscripts that we have of the New Testament, between the different manuscripts that we now own. We don't have an original copy, an autographed copy of the New Testament or of any Bible book. This much is absolutely true. We only have the copies that scribes made. But we are able to actually discriminate between these copies and among them and evaluate the differences when they occur. In the vast majority of cases, these are no more significant than a spelling mistake, and the only thing we can criticise the scribes for is not having a spell check. Or they're copyist errors that are just easy to spot and easy to account for. With more serious differences, we are able, by grouping the texts, the different kind of copies and manuscripts, into families, we are able to trace where some bias may lie or where some alteration may be made. Some scribes did have barrows to push. Some scribes wanted to impose their views on the New Testament and to say what they wanted, to have it say what they wanted to say. But because we have so many copies, we can see where they did it. We can check it, and the jig is up for them. They've been exposed by this process. But the vital thing for us to recognise is there's no cover-up or conspiracy to hide the truth here. This is not new. For 500 years, this process has been an open process that people have had access to in all the universities of the world. we hear these things sometimes announced by a critic as if nobody's known this before, and perhaps if we haven't heard it before, we're led to think, well, my goodness, the church or whoever that is hiding the different manuscripts. But in fact, that's not the case. Study has been open to this public scrutiny for so long. The Da Vinci Code version of the Bible is a conspiracy concocted by a mean, nasty church with kind of bald guys. Is that in the movie? Yes. Is just the stuff of knowledge, the stuff of exciting novels, but it's just not the stuff of reputable history. So what about other gospels? The third reason that people kind of bring forward to say, look, the Bible's not reputable historically. Aren't there other gospels that we've now found that might say things about Jesus, granted that he existed, that have been suppressed by the church? The Gospel of Thomas, you may not have heard of that one, but that's been doing the rounds. The Gospel of Judas or the Gospel of Barnabas and so on. Weren't these excluded from the Bible because the church was frightened of the truth that they might proclaim? Again, this is a popular kind of thing to put forward, but it's not something that scholars would at all accept as a challenge to the authenticity of the New Testament. Many of these texts, the Gospel of Thomas does exist, and the Gospel of Barnabas and the Gospel of Judas, but they emerged from a distinct group a couple of hundred years after Jesus, called the Gnostics, who tended to blend a variety of religious beliefs together. Mostly they were situated in Egypt. And they were known to Christian writers of antiquity, in Irenaeus, who was in Lyon in France, and he was writing in the early 3rd century, and he argued strongly on the basis of the contents of these texts that they shouldn't be considered to be authentically Christian, nor were they in fact purporting to be historical in the same way that the Matthew, Mark, Luke and John Gospels were, the Gospels of the New Testament. And the fact is, although there was some initial excitement when these things were dug up from the sands of Egypt in the 20th century, most scholars, by far the overwhelming majority of scholars and historians, again, of whatever background and stripe, now regard these as of no value for understanding the life of Jesus. So if there was a conspiracy against these Gospels, it was for very good reasons. If they were excluded, it was because they were well worth excluding. Okay, but you might say, okay, granted, but the Bible, is it a good book? We call the Bible the good book, right? The good book says. But is it really? Is this really a good book? Despite all what I've said about its influence, is it really also got a dark side to it? Critics of the Bible love, of course, to pluck out a verse or two, especially from the Old Testament, and point to the strange and apparently barbaric things that are mentioned there. It does seem that the Bible, if you just kind of open it randomly, is full of these sort of bizarre rules that people at the local church don't seem to be very intent on keeping. Things like not wearing a garment made of two types of cloth, or not eating shellfish, or capital punishment for rebellious children. This kind of thing. I haven't heard that at St. Blog's on the corner. They don't seem to be doing that. What's going on? What's more? The God of the Old Testament, people say, it seems like a very cantankerous old fellow. He seems rather grumpy at best, and you hope you get him on a good day. But mostly he doesn't have good days. He's mostly mad. He seems grumpy and irascible. And Jesus seems so different from that. He seems so with it and cool and loving. Now, how does this all hang together? The Bible, you might say, doesn't seem to be morally consistent with itself. Well, I'd say we need to read the Bible as it is and not as we think it is, or not as we imagine it to be. I said before, the Bible is a grand sweeping narrative. It's a grand story. A story about the whole of human existence. It's not primarily a rule book. It's not a moral code from which we selectively may pluck whatever principles that suit us. It's a story of God's attempt to woo our hearts, the hearts of rebellious and fickle human beings. We need to read each part of the Bible as part of that story, as leading up especially to the coming of Jesus in the New Testament, and as leading away from him, as every part of history is leading away from that one point when Jesus came. He is the piece of the puzzle that makes it all hang together, that makes the Bible a unity, makes it hang together as a story, as a consistent whole. Most people have found this man to be a compelling individual, just as they've read about him in the Gospels. People like Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist, the author of War and Peace, or Gandhi, even non-Christian, these two non-Christian or strangely Christian people might have found Jesus to be a compelling person. But he wasn't the kind of precursor to the flower children, or a proto-hippie, or a kind of John Lennon of his day. I think that's the kind of image we have of him sometimes. But he said some very confronting things about our humanity, about our self-justifications, and about our hypocrisies, and about our grandstanding, and about our pride, and about our exclusions of others. He exposes us because of this man that he is, and because of the people that we aren't. His life was everything that human life should be, and everything that our human lives aren't. But he was also the message and the means of God bringing back human beings to himself, of making peace with them. And this is where, actually, Jesus is exactly like the God we meet in the Old Testament, who isn't actually half as cantankerous as people point out, but has some stiff things to say about human beings and their behaviour, and especially about religious people, I have to say. Religious people are most often the targets of the Bible's judgment in both Old and New Testaments. But also the Old Testament and the New Testament both speak of God's determination to win us back for himself. And Jesus, just like the God of the Old Testament, presents a powerful expose of us, of you and me, in our weakness and our failure. He shows us how God loves us to death. And so that's why I want you to read the Bible, to take up the challenge to read this book. If you haven't read it for yourself, or if you've only read it when you were a child, or had it read to you, or had it read to you in English that really didn't make a lot of sense. The famous English poet W.H. Auden once asked a friend, he said, "Have you been read by any good books lately?" I love that line, because good books will do that, won't they? They won't just be entertaining to read, they will read you. A good experience of reading will actually change you. Reading a good book will actually transform you and challenge you. It will ask questions of you. The Bible is a book that does that more than any other book. It's a book that challenges us profoundly as human beings. It rubs us red raw. It stabs us in the heart. It questions all our assumptions about ourselves. It asks, are you right with God? Are you right with the person who made you? Do you know him? Are you really what you were made to be? Or are you somehow less than that? And it asks us, perhaps hardest of all, have we got the humility to accept the love of God for us and the forgiveness that he offers in Jesus Christ? I think it's no wonder that a king like Henry found this a challenging book and didn't want it getting out. So I want to challenge you. Have you got the guts? Have you got the guts to read the Bible? Sure, look, read it to be culturally enlightened. In this 400th anniversary of the King James Version, by all means, read it. And so that Richard Dawkins won't think that you're a barbarian, I wouldn't want that to be the case. But have you got the courage to open this book and see what it has to say about you? There's going to be some opportunities, I think, given to us to show how that might take place. It might be that you want to, at the end of the evening, you might want to read with someone who's read the Bible before, or perhaps you just want to get on with reading it for yourself. But in the meantime, I'd be very interested in your comments and questions, and so I'm happy to take them. I'm handing over to Ricky to kind of be the conduit by which questions may come. Is that correct?
Yeah. Great. Herein lies the difference between, we used our theme for tonight, God Book, as a play on the term Facebook. On Facebook, someone might have seen a video of Michael talking, and Bert might have said to Ernie, "Hey Ernie, look at this," and he clicks like, and they like, look at it, and that's it, that's the end of the interaction. But here you can have the opportunity to ask the person who's presented some of the elements of what you've seen here. And I think I wanted to congratulate all of you for coming out tonight, because it's a countercultural thing in the way that society's going, to actually come out with other people, listen to a speaker, and then have a question and answer time as well. use that opportunity now to use those question cards. I'll give you Phil's mobile number again if you want to use an SMS. 0422 226313, 0422 226313, if you want to SMS a question to Phil and he'll bring them up to me. A few housekeeping matters. Phil has the box, the blue box. The box will circulate and drop your questions in there. The cards are on the table. Just a few other housekeeping things. Some more food will come out if you didn't get enough before. Make sure you grab some of that. And also, if you came through this door or you didn't register or pay, there is a counter up in the corner there. If you get the chance, we've got about 15 minutes to eat, register, drink, question. So feel free to do that. We'll come back at about 7:05 and then we'll have that question and answer time. Thank you, everyone.
Up to a point, that is, you can examine each major religious text in its own context and what have you. But the question would be, what it would be interesting to ask, what fruit has each text borne? And you can have an interesting comparative study. There are other religious texts that have led to very, very structured societies in which it's impossible to move up and down the caste system, for example. It's been interesting to see in the 19th and 20th century the challenge that the coming of the Christian scripture brings to a society based on that kind of religious text. The important thing has been, as I said, Christianity makes historical claims about an event, and other religious texts don't tend to do this. They tend to be pieces of philosophy or wisdom. Christianity isn't that. Christianity, there is wisdom in the Bible, but the Bible is about an event. The question is, does that event, especially the resurrection of Jesus, does that stack up? Is that a kind of event that's plausible, that's believable? The way the texts talk about that event makes sense. And if it does, it really rather makes redundant the inquiry into other religious texts, because this one, risen from the dead man, clearly if his claims are true, then we've found what we're looking for. So I'd urge you to start here, since we're in the culture that's been influenced by the Bible. Start here and look at that.
Okay, thanks. One that was written down. Good question. Doesn't make any assumptions. Does Genesis, the first book of the Bible, teach that the world was made in 6 days? And if so, how does that square with science?
Okay, so the question is, does Genesis, which records in its opening chapter of Genesis chapter 1, it talks about the making of the world by God through speaking. God speaks and things occur, and it talks about the 6 days that he takes to create, and then the seventh day in which he rests. The famous question is, how does this square with science? Now, this is a question which divides Christians, and there may indeed be Christians in this room who have a different answer to me. However, I'm convinced that Christians have always interpreted that text, and in fact, the Jews before them, as not meaning six literal days in the sense of six 24-hour periods, and that this text is really talking not about the kind of time frame, in the sense that we would understand it, of creation, but talking about how the creation was done and who did it. So it doesn't contradict what we might discover through our scientific inquiry, because it's actually talking about something else. It's actually giving us the question that science can't answer, which is, what's the purpose of this place? And who made it? Is there a who behind it? So I think it's asking and answering very different questions to the question that science is asking. So I don't perceive there to be a clash. And in fact, from a very early date, Christian interpreters always understood this to be the case.
Okay, another one from SMS, which you'll notice I'm reading from paper. Can you attempt to understand God purely using logic without a Bible?
You can try anything. So can you attempt to understand God purely using logic? Well, of course, as, yeah, I think you can try. You can certainly, I think, using reason, we can get some very good hints that there must be a divine being. There must be a divine being of some kind. And it's still the case that by far the majority of people in Australia, even in a secular country like our own, even in a country like Britain, where, church attendance is quite low, even there, it's the case that most people think that there is a God. Come to the conclusion that there must be a God. And you can take a number of different tacks on this. You can talk about what must be the first cause of all things. You can talk about design. Is there a kind of, there seems to be a design to the universe in which we live. Now, none of these, though, is a knockdown, lay down as air kind of argument. And it doesn't give, all they give you is a sense that there must be a divine being of some kind. They don't give you what Christianity is claiming it has happened, and that's a revelation of God, something of God making himself known to us. That's what the Bible is claiming about Jesus, about that's right at the centre of the Bible, that we discover in Jesus not just a kind of hint about God, but we have the possibility of encountering God himself as he is, as opposed to a kind of hint about his existence.
All right, thanks. I might preface this question with an experience I had recently staying at a cabin, opening the cupboards, which are empty, of course, when you arrive and you look to find a Bible there, boom, sort of says to you from the cupboard that there's a Bible in there. And I don't think I've ever picked up one of those Bibles. But, and even in today's culture, reading a book is becoming slightly less and less with time. I mean, with these iPads and that, you would read it. So, bearing some of those things in mind, why are people, this is the question, why are people afraid to read the Bible?
Well, I don't think they're necessarily afraid to read...
Yes, there is an assumption there.
There's an assumption, yeah. I'm not so sure that people are afraid to read the Bible. I think partly people have had bad experiences of church. This occurs, and they associate the Bible, of course, with church. And so they remember it from their childhood, or it's been a kind of experience of going to scripture classes or something like that, where they've heard the Bible stories, and they've never really read them as an adult, as a mature adult. And so I think it's kind of that reason that's keeping people... I mean, you might tell me, it'd be interesting to know from first-hand evidence what might keep you from picking up the Bible again. I don't think people are necessarily afraid. I think we actually do live in a highly literate culture. Book sales are through the roof, actually. The more the internet goes, the more someone like Amazon wants to sell us books. So book sales are fantastic. People love to read. So I'm saying, you know, let's have the courage to actually read this book as mature adults and not in the kind of Sunday school frame that we perhaps have only read it in up till now.
Just sort of following on from that as a further question, I tend to see on the internet, just bearing in mind the theme somewhat, little verses shot around here and there, one verse here or there. Is that helpful for people, or is it better to pick up the Bible and read a larger chunk of it?
I think it's always more helpful to read in context because, as I said, the Bible isn't... There are parts of the Bible that are kind of wisdom for us, you know, little things we can put on tapestries, if that's what we want, or tattoo on our arms. But mostly, the Bible is actually like normal literature. It's kind of like letters. You read the whole of the letter. You don't just read a bit of it or a story about a person, the history of someone. You read the whole thing. You want to know how the story begins, what its middle is like, and what its end is. So always read in context. I mean, it's kind of a golden rule. I used to be an English teacher, and you know, we used to whip kids about this. No, we didn't. We didn't. We really didn't. You know, we used to mark them very harshly for not reading in context. I mean, it makes good sense to me.
Sure. Just speaking of some of the things that are in the Bible that you might encounter and find a bit hard to understand, Richard Dawkins has made an emphasis on some of these things when he calls God a moral monster. This question asks, he ordered Israel to kill women and children in some places. How do you make sense of that?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things to say here. In the Old Testament, as Israel, the nation of Israel, came out of Egypt and were a slave nation, became a nation, and then went into the Promised Land, and they were ordered then to go about and conquer the countries that were there. And some of the commands that we hear there for what they're supposed to do seem quite extreme to us, especially, you know, they seem, you know, kill the whole lot seems to be the emphasis here. The first thing to say is that we need to go and read the Bible carefully as the literature that it is. And so the scholars will point out that when they're called on to make war on these particular nations, and it seems as if they're being called on to kind of obliterate them in this sense, that in fact you notice later on in some of the narratives that there are still some of the people left. So quite clearly we have here a rhetorical excess, a kind of exaggeration for effect, a kind of we're really going to be Collingwood next week. We're going to just destroy them. You're not really going to destroy
them.
One can only hope. But right. So that's the kind of they will point to this kind of thing. So that the actual the commands to kill alleged commands to kill women and children are actually not what they appear to be, is what scholars seem to be saying now. The other thing to say is that we again need to read the Bible in the sweep of the context of the whole narrative, that this is a particular moment in history, that there are particular circumstances in each case, that there is a chance for, and in the stories there's a chance for the nations that they're addressing to actually be spared. There are those kind of opportunities. And that in the end, of course, as I said, Jesus is the key here. There's no sense in which the Bible could validly be used as a kind of marching orders for genocide by any culture or regime in the modern day. That just could not be done in any kind of feasible way. It's very important to say that if you're reading from the New Testament's point of view, you could never use those texts in that way. That would be just kind of ridiculous.
Okay. Michael, clearly you've read the Bible a lot, and you're, I understand your father's a minister of religion, you've grown up in a Christian family.
Yes.
So you've spent a lot of time reading the Bible. Have you ever challenged it yourself? This is a question from the audience. Have you ever challenged the Bible? And if not, why not?
Certainly I've challenged the Bible. I mean, as anyone will know, of course, one of the struggles as a young person growing up is what you're going to take from your parents, what you're not. You know, and the challenge to how are you going to be your authentic self, true to yourself, in such a way as you receive good from your parents. But and so I went through all those particular struggles. I felt you know, invalidated by people who said, "Oh, you're a Christian or Bible believer just because your parents are." I felt certainly that made my faith somehow less true. It wasn't until I was really personally challenged about my own need for God, because of course ministers' kids can be self-righteous little kids. Is any of ministers' kids here? No doubt. They need counselling usually too. But they can be self-righteous little kids, and I certainly was a self-righteous little kid. And the challenge that came to me was to see that I, in fact, was as needy as anyone in terms of the claims of Jesus here. But also, in challenging the Bible, I remember I studied history at university as well as English, and I remember vividly one time, age 19, as a historian, putting my historian's hat on and going to a group of my Christian friends and trying to argue with them about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and trying to argue with all my historian's might, such as it was, that that could not have happened, it did not happen, and I found that I could not with any integrity do so for myself. I've certainly questioned that, and I continue to. I don't think that I kind of just rest on my laurels. I think the Bible itself is it's making some big statements about the world. The funny thing about the Bible is that it actually gives voice to our doubts. It gives voice, especially to that the presence of evil in the world, which seems such an oddity if there's a good God. The Bible doesn't hide from that question. It keeps expressing it. It keeps telling. It gives voice to that. It even gives, in some of those psalms, like the psalm we heard in the boat, it actually gives voice to anger and rage and doubts towards God. So it's a book that's much more flexible than people sometimes realise. It speaks to us even in our doubts and gives voice to them as much as in our faith.
Why is the Bible it's a story about a Jewish nation, by and large, and then people in Israel as it was 2,000 years ago. Why are these characters relevant to us today?
Why are they relevant to us today? They're relevant to us today not because they're kind of patterns of what we might, because we can relate to them necessarily, but because they take a part in this grand story which ends in this man Jesus, in which the claim is God does business with humanity such that human evil, human hypocrisy, human weakness is dealt with in such a way that we can actually access that. Now, having said that, the characters of the Bible are remarkably human and in all their foibles. And so some of the great heroes, this is the funny thing about it, that some of the great supposed heroes of the faith, like Abraham and Moses and David, what they're known for is their lack of faith, their doubting God, their diabolical sins, and those kinds of things. It's kind of a what's and all expose. And so anyone can, I think, find something to relate to in those stories. Yeah.
Okay. In the historical story about Jesus' activities, the question here comes, does the historical demonstrability of the Bible extend to Jesus turning water into wine?
No. The answer to that is not directly. That is, we have no other witness to that. We do have an eyewitness to that, and that's in the Gospel of John. So we do have a historic, a text which purports to be historical narrative, which is a witness to that event. That's one witness. But there's no counter testimony. There's nobody else who says that. In some of the events of Jesus' life, there were three or four different witnesses to it. But what makes it believable or plausible, again, is the one event at the end of all the gospel narratives to which we have many witnesses and many lots of testimony, and that's the resurrection of Jesus. It seems to me that if that particular event took place, then it kind of validates or makes plausible, makes reasonable, accepting the other parts of the text. If that text shows that the witnesses are reliable witnesses, then we can start believing what they say. And so I hold that to be something that actually occurred, but I'm quite aware that as a historian, I can't say that I can't just on its own terms say, yes, this occurred. I'm basing that on the reliability of the witnesses at other points.
Yeah. I've got three more questions which I've sorted into historical order, I think. This question here, have you considered the possibility that Gutenberg, you might want to explain who Gutenberg was, have you considered the possibility that Gutenberg's primary contribution to Western civilization through increased literacy lies in its exposure of the Bible as nonsense rather than truth?
Not at all. Gutenberg was the first printer of the Bible in Germany. And so he's the first printer of the Bible. So when you get printing, it's a technology which, like iPads, changes everything. So Tyndale, of course, is in that kind of period when you've got printing. All of a sudden, literacy becomes something that is available to everybody, if necessary. Of course, everyone's going to have a Bible, etc., etc. And I don't think actually the real contribution is. The question has an assumption in it, of course. I don't think that's really his contribution. I do think that by giving the Bible, making it readily available, he does make it possible for us to evaluate it, each individual. He makes it possible for individuals to hear what the Bible's saying and respond yes or no. And it's interesting that this is kind of the basis of religious freedom. The basis of our secular state is, in fact, the notion that you have to be persuaded by a particular faith. You can't be coerced into it. The Christian faith, you can't be forced to believe it. That just makes no sense at all. And so Christians truly should be in favour of religious freedom always, because they should be in favour of persuasion, because that's the kind of faith that they're preaching. And so the Bible in the common tongue and the Bible spread and sold and distributed widely is fundamental to that kind of thing, and the basis for people being able to say that I'm not persuaded, and I think it's nonsense too.
Is it arguable that the Bible, through the Gutenberg Press and others, just became the tool through which the church was able to spread rapidly throughout the world and be an organ to control people's religious thought? I mean, did the Bible challenge religious institutions?
Well, I think yes, it certainly did. I think at the Reformation, that important time when the power of the church was challenged. I mean, it was the people reading the Bible for themselves in their own languages that was sort of fundamental to this. And I would say it reflects the contents of the Bible. As I said before, one of the great targets of the Bible is religious hypocrisy, pomposity, self-righteousness, self-justification, the kind of thing religious people are often very good at. All of those kind of things. The Pharisees, of course, are the classic example. And so the Bible is always a challenge to institutions, to church, religious institutions. That doesn't mean that religious institutions themselves are, therefore, always a bad thing. But it means that they can't, you know, the Bible is not owned by them. The Bible is not the church's book. Churches, such as they are the result of the Bible. That's very important to say, to get that in the right order. And churches can be criticised on the basis of the Bible. And so they ought. And it's been one of the features of the last 20 years that sometimes it's been people outside the church, or the different churches, who've been able to say, look, you're not doing what your own text says, and you ought to change. And that's been a great thing.
Okay. Moving forward a little bit in history and even to today, how does the Bible influence the establishment of healthcare hospitals?
Yeah, I made a kind of radical claim there that the Bible has been kind of instrumental in the practice of modern medicine. This goes right back to the early times of the church. Ancient doctors were fascinated by the practice of medicine, ancient Greek and ancient Roman doctors. But the best they knew to do when an epidemic came through was to run away, because you get sick if you hang around sick people. What the Christians did was to stay with sick people and to pray for their healing, but to take care of them of course they only have very rudimentary medical knowledge in those days, but to stay with people and to care for them as whole people, which is the kind of basis of what we know now as the kind of hospitals and nursing, was a radical step in the ancient world. And Christian sick people got better. And this was this was shocking, of course, to the pagan practitioners of medicine at the time. Through the centuries, of course, it's been the monastic movement, and then again, Christian organisations or Christian-based organisations that have set up hospitals. And even today, Christians have been very much involved in the practice of and support of medicine and hospitals and that sort of thing, in arranging them such as we have. Florence Nightingale was very well known as a Christian in her time, and she's sort of the grand dame of modern nursing, as I'm led to understand.
Okay. Yep. This is the last question, actually. A gentleman came to explain this one, so I'll try and paraphrase it for him, for the rest of you. Moving to today, you hand a Bible to someone, and how do you handle the potential cultural misinterpretations of what's in the Bible, or how they are going to read it themselves?
Well, each person ought to be able to read the Bible for themselves, and people have given enormous resources to translating the Bible into language that people can understand. But it's like any object in the world. It needs to be read in context and understood and argued about and talked about and challenged and chased through and all the rest of that sort of thing. So we need to... those kinds of resources are much more available to us than they have ever been before. And so we have the opportunity for self-correction all the time on these kinds of things. I teach at a theological college where we spend an enormous amount of time doing this kind of thing, helping people to get practiced at reading the Bible. The thing about the Bible is it does challenge our cultural assumptions back. So very often it sort of just it just kind of won't let you rest with what you think is normal when it comes to your cultural assumptions. So hopefully even just a bare reading of it will do that to people. I mean, I hope I grasped the question there.
The points here about translation. Points here are about translations and interpretations and ways that you can help someone understand what's in the Bible.
Yeah, and there are many different ways. Many helps on on the internet, of course, is full of the good and the bad, but there's much available that will help you. We offer courses for instance, at our college, which are very much for lay people, very much you can do it yourself, and that's one way in which you could get a grasp of the whole. It's very important to understand the whole of the Bible, because the parts only start to make sense, as I said before, once you get the whole.
Okay. Yeah. All right, well, we'll leave it there because we want to be disciplined about the time frame.